Erev Tov, everybody. On behalf of Torah Moshe, I want to welcome you to another, what I'm sure will be a fascinating series by Dr. Mark Shapiro. It's Monday nights have not been quite the same for the last few weeks after we took a hiatus between our two new series, and we're looking forward to an extended series on the rise of reform. Really, Dr. Mark is an expert in so many fields, and of course, anything to do with modern Jewish history. And we look forward to his fascinating insights and questions. And, you know, over the next number of weeks, of course, as I'm sure you all know, he's a professor at University of Scranton. He's the last person actually to get a PhD under Dr. Chorsky at Harvard. And he is a graduate of Brandeis, and he's writes many articles, books, and the Sfarim blog, and all over the place, and really always a pleasure to learn from and to learn with. And Vakasha, Dr. Mark, we're looking forward to your new series.
Okay, thank you, and I've learned my lesson. I'm not going to say how many weeks it'll be. So, and those who've been with us before know that although the topic is, as Rabbi Kelman mentioned, we will go through many byways and highways as we get there. And really, my interest is not so much reform. And we're not going to be looking at what many people think of when they think reform, although it's the origins of it. I'm going to be doing, maybe we'll move beyond this, but what I really want to do is the first generation. Talk about, and not just the first generation, the generation before the first generation, the great dispute that broke out about reform, what the early reformers were about. It's a reform that in many ways will look very similar to many of our communities. And it's quite interesting to see that something that we take for granted in many respects today was so controversial then, and why the Gedolim were so opposed to it. It's a one generation thing, as we'll see. And then, of course, if we want to move forward, we'll move into the areas that people know about, Geiger, Holtheim, and the rest. So, yes, I'm happy to be back. I was in Israel. I didn't see any of you in Israel with me, but I was there and I found some amazing things, which maybe later or in a future class, I'll show you some of the things I found. You know that I always begin classes, review the last time, but since we're starting afresh, we're going to get right into it. But there are three things that at the end of class I will get to, because the last class we did on Shaul Lieberman, number 18, I said something and a couple people sent me in something responding to it. And then I have one other thing about Lieberman. And something about Der Yassin. So relevant. So I'll wait. I'll do that at the end. But without any further ado, let me begin. Of course, as Rabbi Kelman mentioned, we're dealing with reform. I don't know if you read the description. If you haven't, please go back. You can click on the email, describe it, because it's not normally what people think of when they think of reform. But it is a sort of reform. It's a change in the direction of Jewish life, and that's what we're going to look at. Now, in discussing the rise of reform, which is where we're going to begin, a class or two before we even get into the meat of it, we're going to be looking at a couple different types of reform. To begin with, as I said already, we're going to look at a reform that for many of you won't seem like reform at all, because it's a reform that's still bound to halakha. And many Orthodox Jews, I dare say, would be very comfortable with this sort of reform. It's a reform that uses halakha, Jewish law, to move forward and make changes. It's a short-lived reform, though. It doesn't last very long. And these early reformers have very little, if anything, in common with the famous reformers we'll also mention, especially one in particular we will get to, Aaron Chorin. If you don't know who he is, he's really a great, great Talmud Chacham, who is perhaps the first of the real reformers that we'll deal about. But it is important what we're going to be seeing, because these Talmidei Chachamim, and they were Talmidei Chachamim that we'll focus on, help open the floodgates, which leads to the other matters we're going to see. We're also going to look at the response of the great rabbis of the day. And all the great rabbis, all the Gedolim, are part of this story. The Chassam Sofer first makes his mark, or Moshe Sofer from Pressburg. God willing, we will return to Pressburg this summer. He, Bratislava today, he, capital of Slovakia, he first makes his mark and really achieves his fame as the leader in this battle against the reform. And the dispute we're going to look at, which was enormously important in its day, is entirely forgotten today. and the individuals that we're going to mention, some of them who were great figures in their time, are also completely unknown. We're going to look at these early texts that, as I said, people don't know about today, which really were in the way of Talmudic disputes. And we will see something that in later years becomes vital for Orthodox Psak. We first see it in these early disputes. What do I mean? The insistence that something can be asur, forbidden, even though the posek, the decisor, cannot actually provide a source forbidding it. That's going to be something amazing. In fact, we will see that the Gedolim across the board will conclude that it's forbidden to daven in the vernacular, which is, on the face of it, quite a shocking conclusion, because forget the Rambam, the Mishnah itself tells you, and the Rambam and all the sources state explicitly that you can daven in B'chol Lashon, in any language. So how is it that the Orthodox poskim almost unanimously will conclude that something is forbidden, even though the earlier rabbinic authorities unanimously state that it's permitted? So we will see that Orthodox Psak, beginning in the 19th century, is not identical to what we think of when we think of halachic decision making. You cannot appreciate Orthodox Psak without knowing that there's something that's not Orthodox that's moving it in many directions. So we'll get back to all this. Now, there's an important book on Reform Judaism. There's a few books on it, but here's an important book for you to know about Michael Myers' Response to Modernity, A History of the Reform Movement in Judaism from 1995. It's basically the classic work on Reform. And right at the beginning of it, he says that the term Reform Judaism is really not the best term. Why does he say it's not the best term? Because he says it limits and obscures the subject. Why? Because not all the people, as we will see, who advocated reforms regarded their position as that of Reform Judaism. In fact, in the first generation, none of them did. Today, you find all sorts of reforms. If a rabbi argues that today, no one's paying attention, so we're not going to say the Yitzhalacha anymore, which happened, by the way, a lot of shuls now are not saying it because during COVID, when they weren't meeting, of course, there wasn't a minyan. When they came back, they wanted davening to be short. So they cut out Yitzhalacha. Are they reformers? They're engaged in reform, but it's not reformers. Shamshon Raphael Hirsch engaged in many reforms that he thought were important, but this is not Reform Judaism. So that's one of the problems with the term. And also it's in retrospect that we use the term. We're going to identify people and say, well, this person's a reformer, but at the time it wasn't necessarily that. And also the term reform encompasses a wide range of things. So for instance, in Germany, you have radical reformers. In England, there's less radical. In Hungary, you have both radical and not so radical. Originally, many of the reformers, and now I'm not just talking about the early generation here, I'm talking about the great ones, Geiger, etc. They believed that these reforms were so natural and so obvious, they would be accepted by all Jews. And in some ways, they were correct. For example, preaching in the vernacular. As we'll see, this was a big problem, preaching in the vernacular. And except for the Hasidim, everyone basically has drushas in the vernacular, including in the Litvisha world. So they thought that all of their reforms would be accepted by the vast majority of Jews. The ones who would oppose it, the rabbis and the Jews, would be a small group who would soon be pushed out of the way, and they would have small followings that would Nebuch type of groups that you can look at it and say, well, these are vestiges of the past. And the young people would clearly move away from these old fashioned types, and insignificant groupies would survive. It didn't work out that way. Although reform is enormously successful, the new traditionalism, which we're going to call orthodoxy, also is able to stabilize itself with a strong contingent. And after the early religious battles that we're going to see, it became clear that reform would not be the Jewish community. It would be part of the Jewish community. And only then can we speak about a movement. In some areas, reform will be the dominant. part of Judaism in Europe. In other areas, it will be a minority. Even in a place like Germany, although Reform would conquer the major cities and also in Hungary, in the small towns, there are plenty of places where traditional Judaism continued and was quite powerful. So we're going to be looking, as I said, at early figures who today are regarded as harbingers of Reform, but did not regard themselves as a movement, and indeed there was no such movement. Now, Reform movement, as you chart it, I don't think we're going to do this. Mr. Ray Kelman says to move forward. I'm interested right now in looking at the first generation. I don't know how many weeks that's going to go, but it's a lot of weeks because we're going to look at some of these texts that most people never look at. But if we move into the second, third, and fourth generation, you'll see it's dynamic with changing ideas. In fact, Michael Meyer writes that the only idea there at the beginning and continuous is that of universalist messianism. Although, as we'll see, even that's not there from the beginning, assuming that what I identify as the beginning of Reform is the beginning. The whole idea, the movement goes through such changes that what was basic in earlier years, that the Jews were not a people. They're only a religion. Jews of the Mosaic persuasion, I mean, Germans of the Mosaic persuasion, that too is jettisoned. Certainly after World War II, it's jettisoned, and Reform becomes the Zionist movement as well. So when do we date the Reform movement? This is going to be a problematic question in and of itself, because we are going to see examples of Reform, real Reform, even before there's a movement. Now, Moses Mendelssohn, Moses of Dessau, he's often regarded in Orthodox literature as a reformer. In fact, maybe even the first reformist. Why? Because he wanted educational and cultural reform, but he did not speak of religious reform, with one exception. We will examine, probably not today, next class, Moses Mendelssohn. In one area, he actually did advocate reform, but he called it halachic reform. It's true that Mendelssohn's followers were, if they were not, well, some were secularists, others became apostates, and others were reformers. But Mendelssohn himself, we will get back to this, had no conception of religious progress in the sense that we'll see that the reformers had. In fact, a major difference between Mendelssohn and the reformers is that Mendelssohn identifies Judaism with a religion of reason. And what's particular to Judaism is the halakha, Jewish observances. Whereas notice for Mendelssohn, Judaism in terms of philosophy has nothing to teach the world because philosophical truth is universal. On the contrary, the reformers had it just the reverse. For them, there's no significance to Jewish observance, to halakha, to mitzvot in the Torah, which Mendelssohn thought were obligatory. And rather, Judaism did have a truths to teach the world, and that's what's important for it. Now, so where do we see the rise of Reform? Well, most scholars, I think, if you look into their writings, will see the beginnings of Reform with the rise of sentiment in favor of, let's call it, doctrinal and religious reform, that is, reform in practice. And this comes about, obviously, with exposure to the world outside of the ghetto. Jews were being, they could move out of the ghetto in Germany, and new ideologies were developed that confront with tradition. The outside world is beckoning. Jews are given a chance to enter into the outside world, and they have a choice. Do they remain traditionally Jewish, or could convert also? Or do they update their religion so they could be modern? It's not for another couple of generations that Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch's revolution comes on the scene that says, no, you don't have to make this choice. It's not a choice of being traditional or reform. Rather, you're traditional or modern. You can be traditional and be modern. But that's going to come in a little bit later. We will see, though, that if we get to it, that the Hirschians and the other German Orthodox, they too favored doctrinal and religious reforms, but they would have called them reforms with a small r. Reform is a European phenomenon, obviously. And although most people associate it with Germany, early reform is found in Hungary, it's found in France, it's found in England. In fact, reform in England is a Sephardic phenomenon. We don't usually think of reform being a Sephardic phenomenon. It's unusual for any reformist movement, and here I'm not just speaking about Judaism, any reformist movement in any religion, to arrive on the scene out of the blue. And usually what you have is a moderate reform leading to a radical reform. Reform movements, of course, always seek precedents because they want to show that they're in fundamental continuity with the past. Now, if they can't be seen to be in continuity with earlier practices, then they'll point to the ideals of the early generation. They'll say, well, maybe we're not in line with the actual practices, but we're expressing the ideals of the earlier generation, that we're the fruition of these ideals. And while opponents of the reformist ideologies will accuse them of being sectarian, the members of the new tradition, the new movement, see themselves as authentic inheritors of the earlier tradition, modified in accord with contemporary circumstances. Here's the big difference between even just 150, 200 years ago and today. In pre-modern, to today, people will say, and this point is made by Chesterton, by the way, in his book, I think in his book Heretics, in Orthodoxy, that it used to be, today, and he's writing early in the 20th century, but certainly people will say, yeah, I'm a bit of a heretic, or I'm a heretic. People have no problem saying it. In fact, it's a point of pride. However, if you go back 200 years ago, and obviously before that, no one would say they're a heretic. Even if you're opposing the Vatican, you're not a heretic. It's the Vatican that's the heretics. And you're in line with the true religious teaching. Well, that's similar to what we're going to see in the early Reform movement and all Reform movements. I look at Christianity and with Protestantism. Protestants are a Reform movement. They say that they're in line with biblical teaching, and it's the Catholics who've gone off the path. And the same is true with Reform Judaism. The members of Reform Judaism, as we'll see, were called all sorts of names by the Orthodox. You'll be shocked at some of the things that were said and some of the actions that I don't think any Orthodox Jews today would advocate or be proud of what was said and done. And obviously, there are plenty of things I'll tell you as well that the Reform did in order to persecute the Orthodox. I don't think any Reform Jew, I don't think any Jews at all would be happy about. But one point I have to make, and it's not because I'm secretly an admirer of Reform or anything like that, but I think we have to be honest. Although, and at the time, for reasons we'll see, it was obvious reasons, it was hard for the traditionalists to make this point. But in retrospect, I think you can. The Reformers were actually very proud to be Jewish. It would have been, remember the era here. The only thing separating Jews from complete equality, entrance to the universities without any restrictions, acceptance at all levels of society, was the fact that they were Jewish. Here you have Reform. We're going to see, we're going to know about these Reformers who have the opportunity to convert, to take that final step, and they choose not to, even though they suffer various disabilities. So in a sense, well, not in a sense, it's actually true, the Reformers suffered for being Jewish, just like the Orthodox suffered, and yet they would not take that final step. Often their children did, and it is a dead end, Reform, in terms of Jewish continuity. But in retrospect, looking back at it, when we're going to see how the Orthodox refer to them, not just as assimilators, as apostates, all these things, I think we have to be honest and say that it was more complicated than this, and that they could have apostatized had they wished, and they chose not to. And that has a lesson until today as well. At the end of the day, the non-Orthodox movements are keeping Jews Jewish, even if only for one or two more generations, but they're keeping them Jewish longer than if they were secular. So I think we need to bear this in mind as we go forward. The fact that these Jews in Germany and elsewhere remained Jewish, even though they were Reform, showed they valued their Judaism, but they wanted an updated Judaism. They think it wasn't in accord with the times. The intellectual leaders of Reform Judaism, and if we get to it in the second generation, we will see this very clearly, not in the first generation. The first generation is going to be all halacha. But in the second generation, they argued that they are the authentic continuation. How could they be authentic continuation? They're not observing Shabbos. They're not observing Kashrus. What's going on here? Well, their argument was that there has always been Reform in Judaism. After all, weren't the Pharisees Reformers, they said? The Torah says an eye for an eye, and the Pharisees says not an eye for an eye. So you're going to tell me that, that's Torah Shebaal Peh. But the Reformers, of course, didn't accept that. They see this as a reform of the Pharisees. After the temple was destroyed, prayer takes the place of sacrifice to a large extent. The Pharisees have to deal with the new reality. So the portrayal of the Pharisees by the reformers, and by the way, this is in opposition to the Christian, the dominant Christian view, which sees the Pharisees, Pharisees, a dirty word for Christians. It's a negative term. So they see the Pharisees as reformers. And the list goes on and on. So they say, just like the Pharisees updated the religion, and they're still authentic Jews, so too we updated the religion. In fact, the reformers claim that every page of the Talmud is evidence in their eyes that the rabbis were reformers. When does the problems arise, they say? When Jewish law is codified through the medieval codifiers and the Shulchan Aruch, Judaism becomes stagnant. But the reformers claim is that reform is basic to Judaism. You have biblical Judaism and you have rabbinic Judaism, and it's designed to continuously update itself had it not been put into stagnation by codification. Now, the reformers claim that if their reforms are more radical than what we see before, after all, abolishing Shabbos, abolishing circumcision, that's a lot more radical than anything you can point to in the Talmud. They're jettisoning Jewish law almost in its entirety. That's only because the era they're living in is so different than earlier eras. And Geiger himself famously said that the question isn't what the Talmud said, but what the rabbis of the Talmud would have said if they were alive today. And the living Judaism that represented Pharisaic Judaism is what they were continuing. And by the way, this notion of identifying as a Pharisee, everyone wants to identify as the Pharisees. The Orthodox, of course, identified as the Pharisees. And their argument was that, yes, Judaism can respond to every change of circumstance. But look how the Pharisees responded. They responded through Jewish law, not through jettisoning it. So they saw it as the abomination that the reformers will say they had anything in common with the Pharisees. When historical Judaism in the 19th century arrives on the scene, later conservative Judaism, we spoke a lot about conservative Judaism last semester. Everyone, you can see it on the Torah Motion website or go to YouTube. The conservative Jews said that they're the authentic Pharisees. And in the 20th century in America, liberal Orthodox leaders like Eliezer Berkowitz and Emanuel Rachman, they claim to be following in the Pharisaic path. So everyone wants to be a modern Pharisee. Not with the scholars. Where have they identified the origins of the Reform movement? Well, as I said, it's only natural there'll be Reform. You have it in a Christian world. You have a secular society now, or quasi-secular, that Jews can enter. So you're clearly going to have a Reform movement. With modernity, there comes a questioning of old assumptions, a rejection of thought to be superstition. And when it comes to Judaism, there's a chance to integrate into Gentile society. And you can't do that with all these religious practices. So all this is clear enough. However, scholars have also examined, were there internal forces and pressures in Judaism that led to Reform, not just external. That is, we want to be part of wider German or Hungarian society, and therefore to be part of society, we have to get rid of, we can't be so different. We can't not work on Saturday. We can't have a synagogue service that doesn't look like a church service. All the things we're going to see to make it look more Christian, we can understand that. However, was there something internal in the religion, in Judaism, that is, in Jewish history, that was pushing towards Reform? And there has been this argument. Gershom Scholem, the great scholar of Jewish mysticism, the one who really created the study of Kabbalah as a field, just like they say about modern philosophy. Modern philosophy is a series of footnotes on Kant. I think that's the phrase they use. The study of Kabbalah are footnotes and discussions of Scholem. I guess you'd say now Scholem and Edel. Well, Gershom Scholem puts forth a revolutionary thesis that the origins, not just of Haskalah, but also, which is going on the same period a little bit earlier, but also of Reform, is ultimately in Sabbateanism, in the followers of Shabtai Tzvi. How so? Because he believes that this sets the stage for Jewish modernity. He even tries to find, especially in Hungary, contacts between late Sabbateans and early reformers. Now, most scholars are skeptical of this argument, and I think all would agree that Scholem was not able to make his case convincingly. Scholem wanted to see the power of Sabbateanism in everything that's important in modern Jewish history. Yaakov Katz has an important essay refuting Scholem. But even if we don't accept Scholem's point that we can point to actual connections between followers of Shabtai Tzvi, we're talking long after Shabtai Tzvi, but the ideas continued through underground in Central Europe, ideas of antinomianism, things like that. But Scholem makes another point, which I think makes more sense, and that's that the Sabbatean movement played a role, set the stage in preparing the ground for reform in another way. The polemics between the Sabbateans and the anti-Sabbateans. And the polemics we're talking about are between great rabbis. First you have it in the generation, but then also between rabbis who were accused of being Sabbatean. Think of Yonasan Eibschitz and his opponents, Rav Yaakov Emden and the Pnei Yeshua. Everyone knows Rav Yaakov Emden. They don't know the Pnei Yeshua is, Yeshua Falk is just as important in this day in his attacks on Rav Yonasan Eibschitz. These split the Jewish world. And Scholem thinks, and I don't see any reason to dispute this, that in the eyes of the people, seeing the rabbis going at each other like this, so with one rabbi referring to another rabbi as a heretic and the other rabbi responding by putting the other ones in cheirim, that all this lessened Judaism in the eyes of the masses. It was seen as just rabbis fighting among one another. And we know that whenever you have rabbis fighting with one another, the masses look at this and it leads to feelings of anti-clericalism. It leads to feelings of, it brings the religion into disrepute. And Scholem's point is that the great battles in the, especially in Germany between the leading rabbis over Yonasan Eibschitz, that this led Judaism into disrepute and therefore a new type of Judaism, one which didn't have all this baggage, which was thought to be more ethical and pure, there was room for it to grow. Furthermore, Scholem calls attention to the antinomianism. Antinomianism, meaning the rejection of the binding authority of halacha, Scholem calls attention to the antinomianism that Sabbateanism presented. And once people are influenced by this idea, he claims that Jewish law is no longer binding or no longer completely binding, this too opens up the door for reform. So, in short, Scholem's point was that the Jewish world is vulnerable to a program of reform. And Meyer is sympathetic to this last argument, but I find it questionable. Because ask yourself a question, the counterfactual. Let's say there was no Sabbateanism. Do you think there would have been no reform? There would have been a reform. All you have to do is look around in the world. You see that in the modern era, enough people want to be part of general society that Jewish laws, just like Christian law, no longer had had to pull over people, and you have a rejection, even in Catholic countries, complete rejection of the authority of the church, you would have had the same thing in the Jewish world. Maybe it came a little sooner, however, because of the breakdown that Scholem discusses, but it's not like you can stop it. Just like you can't stop COVID with everything we do, you can't stop reform. If the Jews are not living in the ghetto and the rabbis no longer have the authority to force them to conform through cherem and everything else, the state permits them to live as they see fit. When notions of rationalism are in the air, are we going to assume that the majority of the population is just going to follow halacha? I don't think so. And we see that when modernity reaches the Sephardic world, it reaches the Sephardic world 100 years later. We see it in Algeria. We see it in Morocco. The same phenomenon happens, although there's no reform movement to speak about, which maybe we'll get back to later. I think the most important point, perhaps, is the social context that Jews are having with non-Jews. Many Jews are drawn into the spheres of power and influence. They start dressing like non-Jews. They want to speak like non-Jews. They start employing Christian tutors for their children. And by the way, all this takes place before there was a reform movement even. We know that already by the year 1700, halachic observance in Germany was declining. Jewish institutions were becoming weaker. You didn't even have rabbis anymore from Germany. They had to import them from Poland. Boys were receiving minimal Jewish educations on the whole, and girls almost nothing. But there was as yet no movement to justify this new lifestyle. but it was not the traditional lifestyle. We have a book here. There's an author named Azriel Shochet, and he wrote a book, Im Chilufei Tkufot, Reshit Haskalah B'Yadut Germania, with the changing of eras, the beginning of Haskalah in German Jewry. And this book documents the rise of irreligiosity and the falling levels of Jewish learning. If you just look at the chapter headings of it, he has one chapter, the changes in life between Jews and non-Jews. Another chapter, the Arkaot Shogayim, Jews and non-Jewish courts. The idea that Jews would be going to non-Jewish courts, this thing never would have happened years ago. The attitude towards the Torah leaders, the crisis in education, Hazil Zuba Mitzvot. He shows plenty of examples of sermons of rabbis and other texts that show that Jews were cutting corners. Jews would go to the fairs and they'd go on trips and they'd be eating non-kosher. Now, mind you, they weren't eating pork or anything, but they were eating like modern Orthodox Jews used to do. They were eating fish out and things like that. And you know this is happening because you have all the rabbis screaming about it in a way you didn't have it before. Chapter 8, Pritzat Gidrei HaTzniut, the breakdowns of Tzniut. You have dances. Boys and girls dancing, and you have all sorts of gatherings, men and women, and girls getting pregnant, and all sorts of things. He goes on and on. And his point is that we usually think of modernity as beginning for the Ashkenazim in the end of the 18th century, and then we're going to have the rise of Reform. And before that, the people say that Jews were isolated from the general community socially and culturally. And Shochet says, no, we have to date Jewish modernity from around 1700. And he shows all this evidence to show that the level of religiosity in 1700 is much less than it was in previous years. So that's the beginning of modernity. And that's going to have implications as to, yes, so the Reform movement, you say, you see the first organized movement maybe in the early 19th century, but reformist ideas are already beginning much earlier. That's his claim. And yet most historians reject this argument, and the argument is rejected most forcefully, and I think correctly, once again by Jacob Katz in a different book. He has written many things in this book, Out of the Ghetto, The Social Background of Jewish Emancipation. When are you going to date modernity, he says? He says, no, you still have to look to the end of the 18th century. Why? Because the issue isn't the facts that Shochet produces. Yes, there's more irreligiosity going on in 1700 than there was in 1600. But what is their significance, Katz says? Were these phenomena in Jewish society simply, I guess, in the nature of variations or deviations from the traditional pattern? Or were they a new process that would lead ultimately to a new structure in society? In other words, were the people who were violating halakha, all these things I mentioned in 1700, was this part of a new mental conception that they were breaking with tradition? Or no? Was this simply a phenomenon that we've had since the beginning of time of Jews breaking with tradition, but knowing that come Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, they're going to have to do tshuva? And or is there a new conception? Do the people feel that no, they ate non-kosher when they went to the fair because they don't accept that there's a halacha that you have to eat? No, but no one has this conception in the year 1700. Yes, the people were eating non-kosher, but they also knew that this was wrong and they're going to have to repent for it. Did they feel the need to atone for their sins on Yom Kippur? Absolutely. And that's what's different. Reform is going to bring a new ideology that you no longer need to atone because what you did is not a sin. There's a new mental conception of a different way to live. And that you do not have in the year 1700. It is still a traditional society with just more sinners. Don't we say in the High Holy on Yom Kippur, we ask to pray with sinners. We've always had sinners. We do not have a new mental attitude. What we have is a variation from the traditional pattern, even the conspicuous variations, but they were still able to be woven into the old fabric. Now, with regard to the growing laxity that begins already in the early 18th century, the rabbis could do little to stop it. Now, why is that? Because the German states started to forbid, and Germany and then was not a country. We speak about Germany, but it was not one nation. It was divided into various areas. And the local states began forbidding use of the cherem. The rabbis used to be able to have authority because they could put people in cherem. Now, what does it mean to put someone in cherem? And this also shows the difference between the pre-modern and the modern. In the year 1700, someone does something you don't like. He talks in shul or he plays cards. So card playing was always forbidden except around Hanukkah time. You put this person in cherem. Now, you put him in cherem, apart from the fact that no one's going to talk to him, it also means he can't go to shul. Now, I might be put in cherem, but I still have to go to shul because I have to say Kaddish or I have to go to davening. So that would be enough to bring people to heal. But with the rise of modernity, well, first of all, the people didn't care. They didn't want to go to shul anyway. And then with reform, they create their own shuls. So the rabbis already by the mid 18th century no longer control the people because the states had forbid the use of the cherem. Why did the states, what did the states care? Well, because it was, these were liberal states. Now, liberal today, a right-wing Republican would be regarded liberal in 18th century Germany. But it was thought to be oppressive to have in Germany, they wanted to do away with oppressive features in Christianity. And you couldn't have the Jews acting oppressively. This is just not how you live in the modern world. You don't punish people for their religious differences. Now, many of these liberals in Germany, they themselves had no attachment to traditional religion. They had universalist conceptions of humanity that Jews wanted to be part of as well. And this would encourage, of course, religious laxity. So when the first reformers arrive on the scene, which we shall see soon enough, let's say the early 19th century, there was not one Jewish community united in Judaism. There were traditional Jews and there were Jews who lived in the community, but really had no connection to traditional Judaism. They were Jews, but they had very little connection. And the fact that they were still in the community says a lot. Okay. I want to give you some figures. Well, I'll leave the statistics for later. In the small towns of Germany, though, what we're going to be looking at now is in the cities. In the small towns in Germany, I don't know of any real statistics, but we know that, so for instance, you take the year 1800. In the big cities, the traditionalists are still the majority. Within a generation, the reformers are dominating the large cities, but not in the small towns. The observant Jews remain dominant in the small towns, and some small towns well into the 19th century. Okay, let's now speak about more practical. Who can we identify as early reformers? I mentioned Mendelssohn before. Is he a reformer? In Haredi circles, to this day, they like to see him as a reformer, although I discounted this by mentioning that he was completely halachic, although he had unusual views about Judaism and that truth is universal, so we can't speak about Jewish truths. But he remains an object of hate in the Haredi world, probably because of what happens perhaps to his children or his students. You sort of can't blame people for their children. You have plenty of Haredi leaders whose children became not just irreligious, apostatized, intermarried. Previous classes, I've given you some names. Maybe I can go down the list if you want. But he does remain an object of hate in the Haredi world, which by and large don't understand Mendelssohn. Those in the Haredi world who are more sophisticated will not claim him as a reformer, but will argue, and this there's a lot of truth to it, that his philosophy did weaken traditional Judaism, although this is not his intention. And I think this is correct. You should know, however, that there have always been traditional Jews, hold on here, great rabbis who thought very highly of Mendelssohn. I can send anyone this article if you're interested, by Meir Hildesheimer. He's the great-grandson of the famous Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer. Moses Mendelssohn in 19th century rabbinical literature. There were many rabbis, Gedolei Yisrael of the highest caliber, who thought very positively about Moses Mendelssohn. Many of the Jews in Germany, the rabbis there, they also thought highly of Mendelssohn. They celebrated Mendelssohn. When the Chasam Sofer condemned Mendelssohn very strongly, his leading student, the Maharam Shik, Rav Moshe Shik, did not accept this, and the Maharam Shik continued to use the Biur, which is Mendelssohn's commentary. There was a controversy in the Aguda circles 25 years ago or so when there was an article by a man today. He works for the Aguda. Then he just was a Rebbe in Providence. So he wasn't bound to Aguda control. Avi Shafran, he wrote this article. All the Jewish observers are online now. He can't say that for the Jewish Action or any of the modern Orthodox things going back there. We have journals going back to the early 20th century, Jewish Forum, the OU had things, Young Israel. None of them are online. I've been trying to get these things online, and no one will put them online. But all credit for the Jewish, for the Aguda that has a website. For a long time, they said they're not allowed to have a website. They have a website. You see it, aguda.org. They put on all the Jewish observers, and those are important historical documents. So in 1986, December, Avi Shafran, Rabbi Avi Shafran, who was then in Providence, he wrote an article, The Enigma of Moses Mendelssohn, in which I have to say he uses Alexander Altman's important book on Mendelssohn. Alexander Altman, it's like a 750-page book on Mendelssohn. He presents really a nuanced portrait of Mendelssohn. And his argument in typical Haredi form, though, is that the real problem with Mendelssohn, it isn't that his philosophy is has the seeds of its own destruction, that there's no real Jewish values, these are all universal values, but still we have to observe halacha because that's not going to lead to continuity, just to follow the Torah because God said to without some sort of Jewish philosophy. That's not what Shafran points to the real problem. The real problem with Mendelssohn, according to Shafran, was that he didn't subordinate himself to the opinions of the Gedolim, the Das Torah, whatever it was called then. In other words, Mendelssohn was like the modern Orthodox, who have lots of good things, but they have this fundamental problem in that they don't subordinate themselves to the opinions of the Gedolim. Now, we all can have ideas, but at the end of the day, you have to listen to the Gedolim, and that was Mendelssohn's problem. He didn't listen to the Gedolim. So it's an interesting thesis, and it presents Mendelssohn. Basically, as I said, a modern Orthodox Jew and modern Orthodox Jews are okay. They have this fatal flaw, but fundamentally, they're Shomrei Torah Mitzvah, so we can relate nicely to them while pointing out this flaw. But that, in the Aguda circles, was not regarded as acceptable because, in their mind, Mendelssohn has to be seen as the first reformer. In fact, this led to the very next issue, an editorial statement on this article. Now, this never would have happened when Shafran was working for the Aguda, because then everything would have to go through the Moetzei Torah. And you can read it here, where they apologize for publishing such a piece. They express their regrets. They quote have the Novominsk Rebbe here of Yaakov Perlow, who quotes to Chassam Sofer and the other Gedolei Yisrael who denounced Mendelssohn. Mendelssohn was a Mesis u'Madiach. They don't mention all the other Gedolei Yisrael who didn't see such a problem with Mendelssohn. That doesn't mean they saw Mendelssohn, everything he did was correct, but they saw him as not an evil person, just someone who errs in certain ways. And then they point out that they blame Mendelssohn's ideas for the way his children grew up. Although, as I said, you can go down the list of Gedolei Yisrael who had the same unfortunate circumstance. So Mendelssohn would be in the Haredi world. He is definitely put in the category of reformers. Well, is there any truth to this? Well, there is indeed one area, and that's going to be the first of our case studies, where Mendelssohn is a reformer. And hopefully we'll get to that in a few minutes. But before we get to that, I want to show you, just give you an example. Those who are with me a few semesters ago remember this, but it shows you already the difference that Mendelssohn is thinking differently. Does this make him a reformer? I think he's thinking very similarly to what many people today are thinking, but he's thinking differently. And what do I mean by that? Well, remember what I said, that according to Mendelssohn, the common ground of natural religion accessible to all human beings is something that Judaism shares, and this will unify humanity. This is not particular to Judaism, philosophic truth. And he doesn't believe, of course, in religious development. But for someone like Mendelssohn, particularism, when you're dealing with, let's say, the fate of one's eternal soul, that's a problem. because everyone should have access to the same truths. And in Judaism, it is, he believes, universalistic. But because of this, I want to show you something. We've done this before, but this is going to set the stage and as we're going forward with Mendelssohn. The Rambam says as follows in Hilchos Malachim, chapter 9, Halacha 1. Chapter 8, Halacha Yud Aleph. Anyone who accepts the seven Noahide commandments and is careful to do them, he's from the righteous of the nations of the world. And he is a share in the world to come. The who? Now, what does this mean? If you accept the Noahide laws, that you have to accept the seven mitzvot and do them. Because God commanded them in the Torah. And that Moses told it to us that the Noahides were obligated in this. But if the non-Jew follows the seven commandments, because he concludes that they're correct, they make sense, they're moral. He says he's not a Ger Toshav, and he's not one of the Hasidim Osolim, he's not one of the pious of the nations, and he's not even one of their wise ones. It's true that there's a different girsa. Instead of Velo Mechachmehem, it's El Mechachmehem, that the Rambam says that he's not one of the Hasidim Osolim, but he's one of the wise men. What Mendelssohn doesn't know about that version, but I'm not sure if that, according to the Rambam, if you're one of the Chachmehem, you have a share in the world to come. You're a Chacham, but who says you have a share in the world to come? Because he begins by saying that who are those who have a share in the world to come? Chasidi Umos Olam. And Chasidim Umos Olam have to follow the laws because they believe it was given by God to Moses. And if you don't, then you're a Chacham, but who says you get a share in the world to come? Although Rav Kook reads the Rambam as saying you do, that's not the Pshat. So this is a problematic passage. Not just for Mendelssohn, of course, but it's a problematic passage because it gives the lie to the concept that the Jews have always held, that unlike the Christians who say there is no salvation outside of the church, here you have the Rambam saying there's no salvation outside of the synagogue. The typical non-Jew, the run-of-the-mill non-Jew who's a moral person, who we're always taught, observes the Shabbos of Noach, but he doesn't do it because God gave the laws to Moses. First of all, he might not... As Mendelssohn said, what do the people live out? I think he said New Guinea. They never heard of Moses. And what about Christians? What about Muslims? So does that mean that no one's Chassid Umot Olam? So Mendelssohn, to show you, I'm not going to call this reform, but it shows you that he's already part of a different era, that this troubles him. And he has a correspondence on this with Rav Yaakov Emden. And Rav Yaakov Emden, who's pre-modern, this doesn't bother him at all. And it's not an issue for him. But Mendelssohn, he's modern. He's already crossed that line into modernity. It bothers him. And I tell you that everyone you ask, if you go and you don't tell people who made the argument, you go into the most Haredi circles, they'll also have an issue with this Rambam and they'll be troubled by it. So who are they more in line with? Rav Yaakov Emden or Mendelssohn? We all, I think, are Mendelssohnians to a certain extent in that, these things do trouble us, and you can see, you know, you have plenty of traditionalist Orthodox who try to discuss this Rambam. Sometimes they say, well, the other authorities don't accept this Rambam. Other times they try to find some justification or they reinterpret it. But the point is, Rav Yaakov Emden wasn't troubled by it. He lived in a different sort of world, a ghetto type of Judaism, where the outside world, that wasn't so much his concern. And he was very well read, by the way. He knew a lot about the outside world. But from a religious perception, it didn't really concern him. Mendelssohn, it did. So I just mentioned this to show an example of Mendelssohn's different thinking. But Mendelssohn did engage in a reform at one time. Is this enough to make him a reformer? Absolutely not. I even wonder today how many poskim would agree with Mendelssohn, but he did advocate a reform. So what is, and this is really the first example of a significant figure advocating a reform in Judaism, I think, at least in the 18th century. I'm not going to look back at Rabbeinu Tam or things like that and talk about the day where he was advocating a certain reform. But in modern times, the very first example, I think, of a reform in Jewish practice is actually advocated by Moses Mendelssohn, although that does not make him a reformer. And once again, he crossed paths with Mendelssohn. Now, what's the issue? According to Jewish law, it's prohibited to delay burial of the dead. And we know we try to bury as soon as possible. In fact, generally, we say that you if you violate a total prohibition if you allow a body to remain unburied overnight. However, there are all sorts of times when you can allow do this, because the issue is disrespect for the dead. However, if by postponing the funeral one day, even maybe even two, because of respect for the dead, that is, people are coming, children are coming, things of that nature, you have to get the necessary items, a coffin in, let's say, Europe, or shrouds, then we allow delay of the burial. But generally, we bury in Europe. In Europe, the way it was, the cemetery was right next. It's not like today, someone dies in Florida, they have to bring him up to bury him in New York or something. You had cemeteries outside of every town. So someone dies, they bury him that day, that evening. They would bury him on Yom Tov. Yom Tov Sheni, you non-Jews do it. Yom Tov Rishon, non-Jews can do it. I asked someone whether in Kiryas Yoel, Kiryas Yoel has the cemetery right next to the town. Does anyone else have a cemetery right next to it? And he says he's certain. He has to confirm it. He's certain that in Kiryas Yoel. So if any of our listeners from Kiryas Yoel, that they bury on Yom Tov Sheni. But for us, we can't do it anymore because we don't live next to cemeteries. And you can't drive, obviously, on Yom Tov. But traditionally, you'd bury them immediately. However, during Mendelssohn's time, Jewish burial practices came under attack by those who said that, hey, who says that the person is really dead? And there were all sorts of stories going about that people were buried and they really were alive. And there were tales where after you buried them, the people were screaming and saying, I'm in here, take me out. There were even things they put in, little bells or something. So if people were not really dead, if they woke up, they could ring the bell. Well, in the end of the 18th century, or 1772, the Duke of Mecklenburg-Schwerin, it's one of the little districts in Germany, he issued an order to the Jews that they have to wait 3 days before burying the dead. That is, someone dies, you keep him on ice for 3 days just to make sure he's really dead, and then you can bury him. And in addition to the medical reason noted above, that you could bury people, they're not really dead, the Duke had been influenced by a Jewish apostate, a Meshumad, who convinced the Duke that the only reason the Jews are burying the dead so quickly is because of Kabbalistic reasons, not because of Jewish law. And Kabbalah, of course, is phony, it's superstition, and therefore the Duke should stop this, and the Duke agreed. Well, the Jewish community turned to two great Jewish leaders, Mendelssohn, who was not a reformer. They went to turn to him. He was the Jewish Plato. He bested Kant in a philosophical competition. Of course, later you can't compare the two. Kant becomes much greater, but at least at the beginning, Mendelssohn was thought to be greater. So they turned to Mendelssohn, who had all sorts of access to a German nobility and leadership. If you recall, in a previous class, we spoke about how on Yom Tov, he was summoned to meet one of the kings, and we spoke about how he rode in the carriage on Yom Tov. We got a heter for that. I told you about how another occasion, one of the important figures wanted to meet Mendelssohn, but it was Chol Hamoed, and he wasn't shaved, so he didn't want to meet with him. So a very interesting figure in Mendelssohn. And he also turned to Rav Jacob Emden, also an important figure in Germany, asking for their opinions. Emden replies that it is absolutely forbidden. We do not change traditional practices of immediate burial because of a far-fetched concern. Far-fetched. What are the odds that you're burying someone who's dead? Do you know how we know they were dead? When you come to me with Prague this summer, I'll show you. In Prague, in the hall where they have the Chevr Kadisha was, they have a series of paintings from late 18th century. And you see everything from when the person gets sick until they bury him. You learn all sorts of interesting things about this. On the one hand, you see after they bury him and they wash their hands, they wipe it with a towel. Today, the minute is you don't wipe your hands. But here we have evidence that in 18th century Prague, they did wipe their hands. But also, you have a picture of the doctor there next to the person who's dying, and the doctor is holding in his hand a feather. You know what the feather is? This is how they determine if someone is dead. They would hold the feather up to the person, and if there's no movement on the feather, that is no breathing, even the slightest, that shows the person is dead. And that's when they bury him. And that's what the Minhag was. That's relevant, of course, to the brain death issue, because if you're brain dead, there's no breathing. You can watch on the HODS, the Hebrew the Organ Donor Society, you watch Rav David Feinstein, his interview there. He says that this is what his father always said. That's how you know if someone's dead, if there's no breath, and that has nothing to do with heartbeat or anything. And that's if you're brain dead, by definition, there's no breathing. So what did Mendelssohn say? Well, we will begin next class with Mendelssohn, because Mendelssohn says two things, as we'll see. He says one thing to the Duke, and then he says something else to the Jewish community. It's the first example, I guess, of being politically correct. You have your answer for the non-Jews, and then your true answer, and wait till you see what the Rav Aaron Soloveitchik quotes Rav Chaim Brisker. And after I tell you that, you tell me, would Rav Chaim Brisker agreed with Mendelssohn or with Radak of Emden. Now, before we end and you get to the questions, let me just, I have to get back. Usually I do this at the beginning of class, and I'm sure this week we'll have all sorts of questions. We usually, for new people who are new, we have a bunch of new, I usually spend 10, 15 minutes at the beginning responding, but I just want to answer a couple things, and then we'll take the questions. I didn't want to start at the beginning because it's a new semester. Anyone know this book just came out? Transmitting Jewish History, Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi. It's a memoir of Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi. Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi, although his name is Yerushalmi, he's born in New York and grew up in a Hebrew and Yiddish speaking home. Became a great professor of Jewish history at Harvard, and then moves to Columbia. He also was at the seminary. But on page 12 of this, he tells a very interesting story about Lieberman, that he was a student, of course, of Lieberman. And he told Lieberman he wanted to go study for a doctorate under Baron at Columbia, but he couldn't go the next year, he said, because it's too late to apply for a scholarship. And Lieberman said to him, "Don't worry, I'll get you a scholarship from the American Academy of Jewish Research." And he did. And he got a scholarship. Yerushalmi says only decades later, when Yerushalmi himself became a member of the Academy, did he discover that it did not give out scholarships. It never gave out scholarships. Lieberman, out of his own pocket, gave the scholarship and didn't let Yerushalmi know. And Lieberman did this on many occasions where he provided tzedakah for people that they didn't know. In the Lieberman and the Orthodox, I've mentioned that he arranges for a refrigerator to be sent to the Karelitz or the Kanievsky. I forget now. You have to look. Family in Israel. He did lots of charity. He made a lot of money on Wall Street, it seems. And so he was able to do that. He left money to Chabad also. At the end of last class, we were talking about challah in a shul on Pesach night. So someone asked me, because I said the Brisker Rav used to walk out. He wouldn't stay in. And that's the old Ashkenazic minhag, not to say it. Many shuls today say it, although my shul in West Orange, New Jersey doesn't say it. I confirm with the rabbi. I'm never there. I'm always away. But they don't say it. But many shuls say it. So someone said, "Well, if you walk out, is it losis go to do?" And I said, "What's the losis go to do? You're allowed to walk out of shul if you want to walk out of shul. What's the problem?" People walk out of shul for all sorts of reasons. My shul doesn't have it, but I know lots of shuls have this thing they call the Kiddush Club. And they decide to walk out of shul. So people walk out of shul. So from my perspective, I thought like the Brisker Rav, if you stand there and you're not saying it, that could be a problem. But if you walk out, two people wrote to me that Rav Moshe says opposite. In Igros Moshe, I didn't know this. I wish I knew it before. Volume 4, Orach Chaim 94. Rav Moshe was asked this point. And he says that today you have shuls, even though they're Nusach Ashkenaz, they still say Hallel because there's Balabatim in the shul that hold like the Gra. So Rav Moshe says that you can't walk out because even if it's not your minug, because now you're in the shul, and if you walk out, you're being Mishanah, you can't walk out because it's like you're creating Mipnei HaMachokas. If you do something different, you're creating Machokas. And if you walk out, everyone's going to say you're doing it because you oppose it, and that creates machlokas. So he says what you should do is just stand there. Don't make a bracha. because no one can see them, and say halal. So I asked already, so why didn't the Brisker Rav stay in and just not say it with the bracha? I think because for someone like the Brisker Rav, if you know about brisk, either you say it or you don't say it. You don't say it just because it's a nice thing to say if it's not a halacha. And you don't, there's no value of saying it without a bracha if it's not just because it's nice. It's a ceremony, and the briskers don't like ceremony. Either you do it or you don't do it. Although, I don't know. I find it, who's me to say anything, but it seems, I don't see why this causes machokes. The Brisker Rav seems to make more sense to me, because today we have all sorts of minhagim and all sorts of things. Is anyone going to take offense if you walk out? Anyone going to think it's machokes? No, they'll think that's just your minhag. Your minhag is not two. My minhag is two. We do what we wear tefillin in. Originally, you weren't supposed to wear tefillin. You weren't supposed to be in shul. Some people wearing tefillin chol moed and others aren't, because the losis go to do. That's a big thing. They say you're not allowed to. You have to, if you wear tefillin and you're at a shul that doesn't, you have to wear it at home so they can't see you. Even in Israel today, maybe that has fallen apart. But today, all our shuls, we do this. It doesn't bother anyone. So I don't know. It just seems to me that no one's going to take it personally. No one's going to think you're creating machlokas. So, but that's where Moshe says.
Mark, I think, yeah. Mark, if I may, I think Rav Moshe also says you can't go to shul with tefillin and not tefillin. We all do that. But if I'm not mistaken, I have to look up. Rav Moshe was opposed to that. And he was very machmir on Lotit Kodadu. He said, if you daven Nusach Ashkenaz or Sfarad, so on Kelad, on Lifnei, or all these on Shochenad, with Fiya Sharim Titala, Lotim Ram, Rav Moshe said, you can't daven out loud. Everybody sitting there in Nusach Ashkenaz, Fiya Sharim Titala, the Chad Sharim Titala, you can't do that. Rav Moshe was a tremendous stickler on these things. And the truth of the matter, I can't see walking, maybe you've never been to a shul that says Hallel. I can see how walking out Dafka for Hallel would create machloket. And my minhag is not to say halal, and I don't assure where they do say halal, I don't walk out for that reason. I come along and, whatever.
If you remember, early in the classes on the 53-part series, we spoke about Der Yassin. This just came out, this article on Tablet. Remember Gil Troy, I think he's from Canada, right? Remember Der Yassin? In which he speaks about Eliezer Tauber's book that was mentioned, it's now been translated to English. All I can say is that if Eliezer Tauber is correct on this, that Der Yassin is simply a bought libel. I mentioned how even some Zionist Israelis acknowledge that there, not that there's a massacre, but certain problematic things, but it does seem to be completely propagandized. And the final thing I mentioned before we get to the questions is only because we've mentioned this a number of times in Rabbi Mazuz's Parsha sheet, number 294 last week, he speaks about this issue we spoke about so many times, kashrus, about the old-fashioned way where you didn't have hashgacha, you relied on the people. And he says as follows in section 8, he says that... He says today it's different, but traditionally he says in Djerba, in Tunisia, sorry, and in Morocco, ein davar kazes sari hechsher al kol davar. He says, if you know that a Jew is a religious Jew and he gives you food, then you eat the food, not a problem. And he says, even he goes on to say that in Paris now, he says, but Sarfat Yishcha Nud, he says in Paris there's a store, Sheyadua Shabal Abai Hut Sadik Vachasid Vere Shamayim, and everyone knows he's religious and he's observant. You don't need to have a Tudah, you trust the guy. But then he says, Ba'aretz Yashar Asokacha. He says, in Israel, you can't do this anymore. So that's one of the things. The only place in the world I said where you have this is Djerba. Today, as I'm speaking, go to Djerba and you'll see all the restaurants there where everyone relies on everyone. So let me get some of the questions. Renewal, someone wants to know what it is. It's a good question. It's not so simple what renewal is. Shaul Magid in one of his recent books, he writes so much now, it's hard to keep up with him, but he has a very good discussion. We have a Jewish renewal rabbi with us, as I heard. But you can read all about the history of it, the background. You heard of Zalman Schachter and Jewish renewal. We have Shalom Schachter. But certainly it's not for me to talk all about Jewish renewal. But it's not reform. It's not reconstructionist. It's very different. Rabbi Kelman says that Vita Ha is a beautiful tefillah, so that yes, but people are not saying it, so they're just talking. Baruch says Hasidim most definitely addresses in the vernacular, and I did. I said that. I said other than the Hasidim, no one has in the vernacular today. Even the Litvish don't have it, but the Hasidim do have it. Although in Israel, the vernacular for many Hasidim is Hebrew, although the drushas still remain in Yiddish. But so, for instance, Ger Hasidim and Breslov and others in Israel, they raise their children and they speak to them in Hebrew, although in yeshivas, they still keep the old practice of and drushas of the Rebbe in Yiddish. But in the Litvish world, in some of the Litvish, they still have in the yeshivas, at least the head shear will be in Yiddish, but not the other shear. Even others, it's completely in Hebrew. Barry, Rabbi Hartman says he heard that Chasam Sofer studied Mendelssohn's commentary on Torah and his ethical will. He told his students to study Mendelssohn's commentary on Torah. Well, no, just punfa care, the exact opposite. He says in his ethical will, don't take Mendelssohn at all. And he says you can't study the commentary. And the famous story is him and the Maharam Shik. The Maharam Shik he was with the Maharam Shik once, and he asked him for a commentary, for a Torah, a Chumash. And the only one that the Maharam Shik had was the Bior, and he gave it to him. And the Chasam Sofer was very upset, and he showed him a passage where he said, is heresy. The Chasam Sofer, the problem was, though, in the ethical will, he refers to him as Reish Mem Dalet. So he gave him some kavod, because Reish there always means Reb Moshe Dessau, or the Lev HaIvri, Rekiv Yosha Schlesinger. He couldn't accept that the Chasam Sofer refers to him as Reish Mem Dalet, Ramosh of Dessau, so he says that Reish means Russia. But it's not what it means. It means Reb. So thank you, Paul, for pointing it out. There you go. David says, is Reb Hudanossi's writing in the Mishnah by evoking Eis L'Chasos Hashem a form of Reform Judaism? Well, for the Reformers, they would say it is, and they thought everything they were doing was Eis L'Chasos. So let me give you another example, and I have to give credit to Rabbi David Miller of the Gris Kolel, then it was BMT I was in, because he was honest enough that he didn't know the answer to it, and he said he doesn't know, and it always impressed me. We were learning a sugya, and there's a halacha that you have to write a Sefer Torah. You have to write a Sefer Torah. So we learned that the Rush famously holds, you don't need to write a Sefer Torah. It's enough if you buy Sfarim. So my friend asked them in Shir, how is this not Reform Judaism? The halacha is you have to write, the mitzvah is you have to write a Sefer Torah, and the Rush says that you don't need to write it. It's enough you buy because the reason is you write it so that you have a Torah so you can study Torah, but now we can learn it through Sfarim. And Rabbi Miller thought about it a while, and obviously it's not Reform because it's the Rush, but he said, I don't know, I have to think about it. You have many examples of these things that, Hasidim, not davening in the proper Zman, all these things. Now, obviously, the Reformers are going much stronger. They're getting rid of marriage. They're getting rid of Kashrus. They're getting rid of Shabbos. But as we will see, the early Reforms, we should start seeing them in the next class, are dealing with much smaller areas. And some that are not even halachically problematic, they're only hashkafically problematic. And I think the answer is that if there's no movement to uproot the Torah in its entirety, you can get away with a lot of things because even if they appear radical, there's no context to them. It's you're dealing with people who are all committed to the Torah. But if you have someone who you have a suspicion or more than a suspicion is not committed to it, then even a small little reform, even like getting rid of Yikum Porkan, that would be regarded as problematic. But in an era where you don't have to deal with that, the Rush, through his genius, could come up and say, well, could conclude that this is the reason for the mitzvah, therefore we don't need to do it. Now, I guarantee you other people disagree with that and say, how could you do that? But then it's an argument among great Torah scholars. I don't know, Eis L'Chasos, they said it's a reform, but Eis L'Chasos is part of the halachic system. The question is, when do you apply it? iPad says the movement to go to Israel in numbers and rebuild it was certainly a reform-like movement rather than waiting for Messiah, was rejected by most of Orthodoxy. Yes, you could say that as well. So what you describe as reform is going to come down to, you know, how you categorize it. This is not a halachic issue, but the opponents of Zionism, including the opponents of religious Zionism, said that this is like a reformist movement, and they saw it as, in fact, if you look at the Satmar propaganda, they see this as even worse than reform. Why? Because reform is just a violation of individual mitzvos or even Torah. It's rejection of Torah Sinai, but this is a rejection even of God himself and of the essence of Judaism. I mean, they use such highfalutin rhetoric, and they regard it as a form of it. Mel says footnotes on Plato. Yes, not footnotes on Kant. Thank you. And iPad says Hasidism was a reform-like movement and originally rejected by many of the so-called Misnagdim. Yes, indeed. And really, the Hasidim should be called Misnagdim because they were the ones who were in opposition to the traditional path. You're right. So reform, however, well, the distinction we're going to see is reform with a small r and a reform with a capital R. At the end of the day, reform with of Hasidus and the others, religious Zionism, they were accepted by most because it was thought to be not in violation of halacha generally and not about uprooting Judaism. With the Hasidic movement, the objections really stopped because a bigger fish was rose on the scene, namely Haskalah and then Reform Judaism. So what, you're going to argue with the Hasidim over these sort of things when you're facing people, especially the Maskilim in Eastern Europe, who want to get rid of traditional Judaism in its entirety? There was no reason for that. David says, apropos of Beitianism, it's probably fair to claim that Hasidism emerged from this earlier movement. Well, if you're a Hasid, it certainly is not fair to claim, David. But I don't even know if from an academic perspective it's fair to claim. There were definitely elements of radical theology out there that you can find in Sabbateanism and that made its way into some, perhaps some Hasidic ideas. But that's not the same thing as saying that it emerges from the earlier movement. Hasidism is not Sabbatean. They do not believe in antinomianism and in the way Sabbateanism argue. They obviously don't believe in Shabtai Tzvi. You have some radical ideas here and there. And yes, you could have the Besht and others talk about, certain maybe the mitzotzot that were found in Shabtai Tzvi. But remember, what develops out of Shabtai Tzvi is Frankism. And Frankism is in direct opposition to the Hasidic world. It's in Poland at the same time, and they were enemies with each other. So you have to clarify, Mel. Okay, Danny says declining observance was often remarked about it by Italian Jews. How or why is that not part of the history of reform? For the same reason that Katz said, declining observance doesn't make reform. The Italian Jews, who are less observant, still went to it's like the non-observant Orthodox. They went to the traditional synagogue. They accepted the old conceptions that if you sinned, you have to repent. There's no ideological movement to recreate Judaism in a new form. There's simply lack of observance because of Jews. The Italian society was open and Jews were able to acculturate much more. So with acculturation comes lack of observance. But just because people are not observing doesn't mean they're reform. If you go to Algiers, or you go to Algiers in, let's say, 1890, you go to Casablanca in 1920, you have lots of people who aren't religious. They're not reform, though. They're not trying to create a new type of Judaism. And thank you, Mel, from Whitehead. Yes, the European philosophical tradition consists of a series of footnotes on Plato. And iPad says, wasn't the Beis Yaakov movement for women's education a reform-like change? Indeed, it was. And that was even brought in halachic issues because the Gemara says not to teach daughters Torah. So you had the Chafetz Chaim said, well, he gave his approval on others. So if you would ask, why is the Beis Yaakov movement not an example of inappropriate reform? Mind you, the Satmar Rebbe does say Beis Yaakov is forbidden because it's reform. But why isn't? Because the traditional answer is, when you have a Gadol B'Yisrael like the Chafetz Chaim or other Gadolim that approve it, by definition, it can't be reform. Now, that's going to raise the interesting question. So we're going to see issues next week where no one would dispute that if a Gadol B'Yisrael of caliber permitted it, no one would object to it. And we are also going to see that rabbis, second-level rabbis, minor league rabbis, did permit it. Now, no Gadol B'Yisrael is going to permit violating Shabbos or abolishing circumcision or anything like that. But all these, the first generation that we're going to get into next week, these are issues that most of the listeners are going to say, why is this even a matter to discuss? Why is this even a reform? But you'll see it is a matter of reform, and they fought over this big time. If anyone wants the article, you have to email me, shapiro.m2@scranton.edu. Shmuel says, is Mendelssohn's B.R. still in print? They reprinted it a number of years ago, but in general, it's not in print, and it was reprinted in a limited edition. Fortunately, today, you can print all these things, because if you go, you can find these on Google Books, and then you could, there are services, I do it all the time, that printed for you. But no, not only is it not in print generally to find, it's not on HebrewBooks.org, and no one outside of academics study it, and it has never been translated to English. Sections of it has, but the book itself has not been translated to English. Someone says, in reference to the point about Sabbateanism being at the root of reform in Shtisel, they call the Kippah Sruga Mizrahi Orthodox folks Frankim. No, that's not referring to Yaakov Frank. If they equate them with reform, it's not about that. And what they call them, they call them Mizrochniks. And that's also a type of reformers. For the Haredim. So Baruch says, Yom Tov Sheni Burial, it's not only done by Satmar, it's done by others too. KJ has a cemetery right near them. Gershon asked, did Mendelssohn correspond with Emden regarding... he corresponded with him about the Rambam's position about non-Jews. That's the two places he corresponded with him on this matter. And Jay's Rabbi Kelman says the origin of the phrase saved by the bell. Correct. Chaim says that burial is done on Muncie and Yom Tov Sheni. Now, Yom Tov Rishon, no, while you can, halachically, you can do it if the non-Jew buries, but it seems that no one does it. And I'm hearing that. And so someone privately says that when she lived in Washington Heights in the 70s and 80s, Brewers buried in Yom Tov Sheni and the cemetery was in Clifton. So I guess that means that they buried without the people attending it. That's interesting. And someone is Zocha here, has his chus, Eli, that Rekovendin is his direct ancestor. He's open-minded on many issues. Yes, he is. And his father wanted to do it with Kitnios. And Rav Yaakov Emden is open-minded, so open-minded, people would say he falls out. He was so, we should do classes on him, but really you don't need to. I can send anyone also. I think I have J.J. Schachter's dissertation. Rav Yaakov Emden is the most unique and unusual person, rabbi, probably of the 18th century, not just a Gon Shebegoni, but interests, wide-ranging interests on anything. You mentioned Kitniot. What about the fact he wanted to get rid of Rabbeinu Gershom's cherem? He wanted, Yaakov Emden wanted to bring back polygamy, as well as numerous other things. Mel says that you say how after davening is over. Yeah, that's different, because that's after davening is over. So now davening is over. Anyone who wants to leave can leave. Those who want to stay, it's an option to stay. That's different if you do it, let's say, before the end of davening, because then you're not saying davening is over. Whoever wants to stay and stay.
My next comment.
Yeah, in KMS, say hallelujah for later. No one walks out. Okay, very nice. I'll just quickly go to the end. Yes, the Araxi of Italian Jews goes back to the Renaissance. Someone says, Nissan, I may have conflated cessation of independent respiratory function with loss of higher brain function, which is not a halachic brain death. No, my point is, and I'm not a doctor, but this is what the doctors say, that if you're brain dead, you cannot breathe on your own. So there is no breath. And if you look on the Rav David's interview, the person doing the interview keeps trying to get him. So you're saying the Rav Moshe accepted brain death. And Rav David says, I don't know what brain death is. Rabbi Tenor might be right, but he says, quote me accurately. Rav Moshe said, the only thing that determines death is lack of breathing. And what I'm told is that by definition, you can't breathe if you are brain dead. Tell me if that's wrong. If not, okay, finally, let me just quickly with my address, email is shapiro.m2@scranton.edu. Last comment, David Eisen. First of all, I thank you so many. There's so many people here. That's great. In Israel, comparisons, and I read it out loud because people will listen to it later. In Israel, comparisons are often made between Sephardi traditional Jews, Masoretim, versus non-Orthodox Ashkenazi Jews, with the former acknowledging their shortcomings in terms of their personal observance, while the latter make ideologies out of their later departure from Orthodox observance. That's exactly the case. The Sephardic world has plenty of people who are non-observant, but the synagogue they don't go to, or the synagogue they go to when they do go to synagogue, is the traditional synagogue. You can't even call it Orthodox, because it's only Orthodox when there's non-Orthodox movements. The Sephardic synagogue, as we know it, is what the traditional synagogue was, let's say, in Germany in 1700, where you have people of all different religious levels. And we still have some of these, David, in America, in Chabad shuls, and if you go out west. But you're right, there is no movement. And because there is no movement, non-Orthodox movements in the Sephardic world, Poskim, for instance, in Morocco, let's say, could come to all sorts of unusual leniencies and even radical ideas that could never happen in the Ashkenazic world, because then they'd be seen as giving in to the reformers. So we've done a lot today. We've only begun, however. Wait till we start getting into the real meat of things next week. Thank you all. Rabbi Kelman, take it away.
Okay, thank you very much. We look forward to next week. A pleasure to see so many people, like you say. And tomorrow, just for those who've been coming to Alex Yizur's class, you probably know, but just a reminder, and we'll hopefully send out an email, he's not giving his class tomorrow. This is regular Tuesday class on Eliyahu. Tomorrow, we resume, please God. Next week, tomorrow night, Dr. Gewirtz finishes his series on the changing nature of halakha. We'll be discussing the international dateline in halakha, or the, if there is even a need for that one. That will be tomorrow evening at 8:30. And then Wednesday, Rabbi Kowalski finishes his series on the different areas in Parshanut. And then Wednesday night, Dr. Sokolov, especially our three classes on Thursday, my class on the Siddur on Friday, back to Rabbi Liebtag on Sunday morning. And next week, actually, we have two series starting. Menachem Kellner is going to start a three-part series on issues in the Rambam. He's one of the world's experts on the Rambam, a longtime professor in Israel, grew up in St. Louis, I believe, living in Israel, I'm sure well-known those who learned the Rambam. And also Dr. Mark will be starting a series of interviews. He mentioned, please go, we'll go to Prague and Budapest this summer. We've been discussing, you know, trips is this. I live in Canada. You know, we have a whole different attitude towards, you know, COVID than Americans do. But anyways, we do hope, please God, we do hope that this summer we will be able to finally go back on some of our trips. And so we will keep you posted on that. But the before we can, with whatever, we will be having a series. Dr. Mark will be interviewing five of the people in Greece, Morocco, Spain, Italy, and I can't remember which one now. Italy, Spain, Greece, Morocco, and Hungary. People from those communities, these are all trips we've done with Torah Motion. That will begin next Wednesday. We'll send you the details about that. So that should be interesting. Just Jewish communities around the world. So those are two new classes starting next week. The week after that, Rachel Sharansky, Danziger, will be starting a new series. So we've got lots of stuff on the go. We look forward to learning with you. Please invite a friend. That's your admission ticket. Please just invite one friend to try a class. And that's the way we grow word of mouth. So a pleasure to see everybody. I want to wish everybody well, and thank you very much. Let us know. We're always willing, happy to hear your comments. Live with everybody. Thank you.